Hey, this is Chris, and welcome to Module 4 of Design Thinking and Doing for Social Innovation. This podcast is being recorded on Kaurna lands, and I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future, and to the elders of the lands on which you're listening today. One of the themes of this episode is the value of diversity when it comes to creativity. First Nations ways of valuing and being and thinking are inherently systemic and relational, exactly what many of our public responses are not. Foregrounding First Nations wisdom in your idea generation process by creating safe and creative spaces for First Nations people to shape thinking is almost certainly going to widen your set of options. In the last module, we talked about how you get to strong opportunities through good design research in the what-if phase. We talked about how good opportunities provide a good jumping-off point for creative responses. And this is where this module starts, with a focus on creativity and how to create the conditions for it. The second half of this module is about how to shape those early stage ideas that might just be a few words or a paragraph into a concept that's multidimensional with considerations for desirability, impact, delivery, and money. This module is going to stop where the what-if diamond starts to overlap with the what-works diamond, the point at which you shift from prototyping concepts on paper or in the room to prototyping parts of a service for real to see if they actually work. So where do ideas as brilliant as roast beef Mars bar come from? Of all of the parts of the design thinking process, the early stages of the what-if diamond, where you generate ideas in response to the opportunities you've identified, is perhaps the most mysterious. I think that's because we as humans are not that great at understanding our own creativity and don't put a lot of focus on it. It's something for crackpot inventors toiling away in their sheds, or it's seen as the domain of musicians and artists, or something taught at art school. Although I went to art school, and I'm not really sure it was taught there, but you did learn a lot about it. The mainstream design thinking literature is very weak when it comes to creativity. Creativity gets nowhere near the rigor of thought as design research or prototyping. So in this module, we're going to hear from musicians, artists, and comedians, as well as a few arch capitalists looking for disruptive ideas to capture new markets. There is something to learn from them all. Creativity is central to social innovation. You can do all the research you want, but it's the ideas that teams invent that define whether you have a breakthrough solution or more of the same. Even the best design research won't do your invention for you. My colleague Dileta has been exploring creativity through conversations between Australian and Indonesian creatives. She has a hunch that creativity is highly personal and different things work for different personality types. And I think she's onto something here, because it seems that nothing works for everyone when it comes to creativity. If you think of the standard design thinking brochure, the visual next to creativity is people in a workshop brainstorming wild ideas with post-it notes. That can work. It used to work for me. But now, frankly, when it comes to idea generation, I'd rather just be alone, walking on the beach after a good night's sleep. So here are some strategies that do work for some people, sometimes, to create the conditions for creativity. Number one, naming the obvious ideas so you can start thinking about the non-obvious. Number two, creating time, space, relaxation, and time away from the problem at hand for ideas to emerge. Number three, having a diversity of perspectives contributing to idea generation. Number four, using well-prepared questions that force unusual constraints. Doubling or halving a key component turning a rule on its head. Prompts that get you outside of the conventions and lead to different ideas as a result. Number 5, basing your solutions on positive deviance you observed in a system during the what is stage. Number 6, remixing solutions from analogous situations where the problem you're working on has already been solved, albeit for a totally different group of people or in a totally different context or industry. Number 7, representing an idea in another form as a metaphor, acting it out or dancing it out. Number 8, forcing oblique or random associations using prompts, a dice or a dictionary. And number 9, stopping the talking and getting on with the making.
Because to sum up something I sometimes take 3 hours to say, all creativity comes from the unconscious. If creativity came from logic and intelligence, then all the logical, intelligent people could do it. But they can't. It all boils down to getting in a playful and relaxed frame of mind.
This is John Cleese of Monty Python fame talking on a Dutch TV show.
Most of it's to do with relaxation, because unless you're relaxed, you can't hear the promptings from the unconscious. You know, nobody ever had a bright idea when they were attacking a machine gun nest. You see what I mean? If you're occupied with activity, and that's one of the reasons why there's so little creativity at the moment, is that nobody gets any peace anymore. Because these damn things are ringing all the time and beep there, and you know, you sit down, there's another email come in. It's absolutely poisonous, because interruptions and anxiety will kill any kind of creativity. So you have to get in a...
There seems to be some good evidence that one of the conditions for creativity is about time and space and a certain kind of relaxation, which can come from an occupation with a task like cooking or gardening or walking. Something that allows the mind to wander.
A 2019 study titled When the Muses Strike found that, among physicists and writers, creative insights often arrived while they exercised, showered, gardened, or engaged in other predominantly physical activities that gave their minds the freedom to roam. Engaging in non-demanding tasks seems to foster productive mind-wandering, which can lead to these aha experiences, says Jonathan Schooler, first author of the study and a professor of psychological and brain sciences at UC Santa Barbara. Schooler points out that mind wandering is a universal human activity. So, from an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense that it would serve an important function. If it didn't, the human brain wouldn't do it. There are countless anecdotes about great thinkers and inventors who recognize the importance of taking breaks to ponder a problem or simply daydream. Both Einstein and Darwin prioritized long daily strolls. Schooler's research defines mind wandering as any activity that allows having task-independent thoughts. Beeman says activities that are too demanding of our brain or attention, checking email, reading the news, watching TV, listening to podcasts, texting a friend, etc., tend to stifle the kind of background thinking or mind wandering that leads to creative inspiration. On the other hand, a positive mood seems to be helpful. Anger, anxiety, and other negative emotions breed rumination or problem fixation, which can suppress the kind of mind wandering that produces creative insights, he says.
One of the most extreme examples of this I read about was a global food security innovation program that, in the middle of their process, dropped their design team in the middle of the Arizona desert to come up with ideas based on what they'd learned in their what is stage. Each person had their own tent and strict instructions not to talk to anybody else who was there for the next 3 days.
If I could ask a question there, I was just wondering, how did you create the space for creative responses to those opportunities?
We brought in a couple of really interesting provocateurs to the co-design process, and also some people from the mental health sector that wasn't sort of service driven. Like we had some members of the Adelaide Crows come into the space.
The Adelaide Crows are a football team. And this is Carla Clarence, once again, from Taxi. And this time she's talking about a mental health project that was led by young people to develop new kinds of community responses.
I think what was really interesting is that the mix of people allowed for very diverse and probably different questions to get posed. So our provocateurs, there were some really interesting folk, some artists that came into this space that were really asking different questions and super helpful, naive questions of, well, why would you do it that way, system, when you could do it a whole other way or do it the opposite? And so the workshops that we had, appreciating that we did have the luxury of being in person, were highly tangible. We made things. We physically made lots of prototypes, and we had a lot of creative stimulus around us in the form of, yes, of course, all sorts of paper and pens, but all sorts of bits of cardboard and small characters and all sorts of stimulus that helped us to really think outside of the square. And I think because the perspectives of the co-design group were sometimes complementary but also polar opposite, sometimes the coming together of those, you think of things you'd never imagine possible or you would have overlooked because you hadn't had that creative coming together. So in short, one of the things to answer your question, Chris, I think is the role of that provocateur. I think that can really lend itself to, yes, we need to think about people that have a stake in the work, but also maybe we also need to think about that external layer of community of creative and sport and recreation and different players in community that also have a lot to add to the conversation, especially around wellbeing and the future of mental health.
Having a diversity of people developing ideas in the room together or even in different rooms, if that's what it takes, is a reliable way to boost creativity. As Tyson Yunkaporta wrote in his book Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World, solutions to complex problems take many dissimilar minds and points of view to design. So we have to do that together, linking up with as many of us other us twos as we can to form a network of dynamic interaction. In a participatory project, you can have people with lived experience in the room. And even in a consultative project, you might be able to build on the ideas developed by people with lived experience in the What Is Diamond. You could choose to include the kind of provocateurs Carla was talking about, people naive to the problem, working in a totally different space, who could help mix things up. And you could choose to include people from different cultural backgrounds. Indigenous perspectives can add value to many situations, given that Indigenous ways of valuing and thinking and being are inherently systemic, relational, and suited to complexity. People can be tripped out of their habitual ruts of thought through some cleverly worded prompts. That could involve identifying the norms of a service or policy and changing them. For example, what if we changed who delivered the service? Families instead of professionals. What if we did something with half the budget or double the budget? Or what if money was no object at all? What if something took half the time or double the time? In workshops, my colleague Dana Shen, a woman with Njurunjeri and Chinese heritage, often asks Aboriginal people to imagine what solutions would be like if they were in charge. It's about self-determination, but it's also about flipping the convention on its head. Dana also talks about Noongar streaming and how if we developed and designed policies and services to work first and foremost for Noongar, for Aboriginal people, there would those new services and policies would work equally well for a lot of mainstream people too.
Not necessarily broken. They're not necessarily problems. Think about socks, for instance. If you were in the apparel business or fashion, what do we take for granted about socks? Our expectation is that we always buy socks in pairs and they match. Okay, now if you were to disrupt that and come up with a disruptive hypothesis, one way of looking at it would be to say, what if we sold socks in sets of three and none of them match? I mean, how kind of crazy would that be? Somebody actually did this. They went and started a company called Little Mismatched. And that's what they do. They sell socks in sets of three and none of them match. And what they found out was that they're a hit with tween girls. So 8 to 12-year-old girls love mismatching socks. It enables self-expression. But the disruptive hypothesis came first. Then they had to find out who would find value in that. Because being disruptive for disruptive sake is just annoying. It needs to deliver value. That's what you need at the end.
This is Luke Williams ranting about socks into TEDx talk. He's author of the book Disrupt, which is all about how you identify the conventions of a particular product or service or industry and then turn them on their head to create disruptive ideas.
Rental cars. This is one of my personal favorites because I was so frustrated with rental cars for so long. And again, a non-technology example. There's no new technology here. It's just thinking about the set of interactions somebody goes through on a regular basis in this business. So think about all the times you've rented a car. Okay? You have to go in there, so they have to see the customer. You have to complete paperwork, and they rent cars by the day. Okay? Disruption, somebody came along and said, you know what? What if we didn't have to see the customer? They could skip the paperwork, and we're going to rent cars to them by the hour. And of course, this was a service called Zipcar in the United States that took the car sharing model from Europe and gave it their own spin.
You have to get pretty lucky for one of these thought experiments to deliver real results, but you only need one to work. I really think there's something to what American chemist Linus Pauling said. If you want to have good ideas, you must have many ideas. Most of them will be wrong, and what you have to learn is which ones to throw away. More about that later. I don't think I've ever worked on socks. In my social innovation work, perhaps the most frequent source of ideas has been positive deviance, people doing surprisingly well, often people that you meet in the what is stage. More accurately, it's been finding ways to replicate the factors that helped people do surprisingly well for others who didn't naturally have those factors around. In the UK, I was part of designing a service called Loops. In the what is phase, we became very interested in a young guy we'd met called Clive. Clive had been in a gang, he'd witnessed a murder, but he got back on a good path because an adult had taken an active interest in him and exposed him to all sorts of opportunities for connection and growth in his community. So in the project, which was all about looking for an alternative to youth clubs, we created a platform, Loops, where adults would support young people to identify their interests and then connect them with developmental experiences across the community, in the same way that an adult had connected Clive to positive experiences in his community. To find out about where ideas come from, I asked a small child. Here's my son, Frank. He's 6.
Almost everyone knows where ideas come from. Up here.
What, up there?
The brain.
The brain. But do they come from the brain alone, or is there other things that you have to put in your brain to get new ideas out?
You sort of have to look at stuff first and then get ideas.
Ah, so you've got to put things in there?
So you basically just have to, or you can just think about stuff and turn it into something else.
Frank is big on stealing his ideas from somewhere else, but then creatively adapting them. I've seen him time and time again watch something or read something in the morning and then build his own version of it in the afternoon. Family by Family is a service we designed at Taxi in response to our findings through design research that helpful help, as far as families were concerned, was more often than not came from another family rather than a professional. The concept for Family by Family is a remix of ideas from different places, all of which was set up in the What Is Diamond. Some of the ideas we remixed came from positive deviant families. We'd sort them out as research participants. And some came from services that we found particularly inspirational in our desk research. Mothers to Mothers is a service in South Africa in which mothers living with HIV talk to mothers to be in hospital waiting rooms about how to avoid passing on HIV to their babies, for instance. This helped us to see what a peer-to-peer service could look like in practice. A whole family educational service for Maori families, where parents and children could learn together, helped us think about how family by family could be a whole family to whole family service. And the Family Independence Initiative in Oakland, California, now called Up Together, which supports small groups of families to provide mutual support and incentivizes them to record their strategies and progress, made us think about the power of group settings in family by family and the power of supporting people to record their progress over time.
I know something that a lot of artists know, but few will admit to, and that is nothing is completely original.
This is Austin Kleon, author of the book Steal Like an Artist.
All creative work builds on what came before. Every new idea is just a remix or a mashup of one or two previous ideas. Here's an example of what I'm talking about, genetics. You have a mother and you have a father, but the sum of you is greater than their parts. You are a remix or a mashup of your mother and father and all of your ancestors. And just as you have a familial genealogy, you also have a genealogy of ideas. You don't get to pick your family, but you can pick your friends, and you can pick the books you read, and you can pick movies you see, the music you listen to, the cities you live in, etc. You are a mashup of what you led into your life.
Where to steal your ideas is a particular art. Design company IDEO were working on hospitals, and looking for a way to improve the speed of hospital changeovers. So they asked themselves who else had solved the same problem, the problem of the quick handover, but in an entirely different context. They came to the idea of learning from Formula One pit crews because of the speed they work at. When you have a good handle on the problem to be solved, then there are no shortages of places to look. I think one of the most lateral connections I was ever able to make in a project was between learning in care and custody services and the debriefing practices of the Israeli Air Force. My colleague Dana Shen regularly uses drawing and poetry and painting when working with Aboriginal people. For example, to imagine future child protection systems as a culturally appropriate form of exploration of alternative futures. Expressing ideas in alternative mediums can be a great way to get to different ideas. If you've been talking, start drawing. If you've been drawing, start acting things out. This is Sense of Doubt from David Bowie, produced by Brian Eno. Eno apparently used his oblique strategy prompt cards to develop the track, as he did for the rest of Bowie's Berlin albums. Each of those cards contains a suggestion, and the only rule is that you have to use that suggestion to inspire your work, no matter how inappropriate it might feel. The cards have strategies like use an old idea, or state the problem in words as clearly as possible, or only one element of each kind, or what would your closest friend do? Try faking it. Honour thy error as a hidden intention. Ask your body, and work at a different speed. My colleague Ingrid Burkett produced a similar set of cards for social innovation, and we've had great success in using them in workshops. And if obliqueness isn't enough for you, why not stretch all the way to random? Open a page of a dictionary or turn on the radio and use that to inspire your next move. The only rule is that you have to force a connection. A I learned a lot about creativity from walking the stairs when I worked at the UK Design Council. The staircase there was filled with quotes about ideas and design. And in fact, it inspired the idea of putting quotes on the staircase at the Taxi Adelaide office. Nothing is original. It's there on the Design Council stairwell that I first read the quotes about to have good ideas, you could have lots of ideas, from the chemist, Linus Pauling. But the quote that I've carried with me on an almost daily basis is this one from Ovid, who I was surprised to learn putting this together was a Roman poet. A new idea is delicate. It can be killed by a sneer or a yawn. It can be stabbed to death by a quip and worried to death by a frown on the right man's brow. And it's the one that stuck with me because on the one hand, I know it's true, and I tell myself to ignore the furrowed brows of others and to even embrace that or look for that these days. But it's also stayed with me because I know that sometimes I can be that man with a frown on the brow. And I hate to think of all the times I've done that and what's been lost because of that. Suspending judgment, or at least visible judgment, if that's the best you can do, of others' ideas and your own, avoiding self-censorship, is a critical part of the divergent phase of creativity. Judge people's ideas and they'll feel judged, they'll clam up, creativity will stop, and we're all on a fast train to mediocrity. Enabling creativity in others may be as much about what you don't do as what you do do. This will never get past management. Whether that's said or it's what people thinking, it still too easily shuts down the creativity. You'll often hear experienced practitioners building on others' ideas, saying things like, let's build on that. Almost following the rules of improvisational comedy, where your response to any suggestion always has to be, yes, and. This kind of improvisational way of working can be very different, especially for those trained in the art of adversarial argument, for example, lawyers and politicians. Now, don't get me wrong. Taking a judgment on what are the highest potential ideas or concepts is a critical part of the what-if diamond. You've got to reduce a large number of ideas into a smaller number that can then be developed into fully fledged concepts. And then you've got to decide what concepts to take forward into the what works phase for further development. But we're not quite there yet. The last creative strategy we're going to explore here is to stop talking about it and start making it. To start to build your ideas on paper or act them out as role play or even build a clickable prototype of a new digital interface or a space made entirely out of cardboard. And here, we take a step into the method that can take us through the rest of the what if phase and beyond into what works, prototyping. You can think of prototyping as one big loop of activity that you repeat time and time again. It starts with a hunch or a hypothesis or a guess. Then you build something. Then you take it out into the real world and test it and get feedback on that. You learn from that testing and then you decide to reject what you're developing or iterate it because you've learned what works and what doesn't work and you know now how to make it better. Or occasionally pivot because it worked really well, but at doing something entirely different from what you planned. This loop of developing a hunch, building it, testing it, learning from it, and then iterating or rejecting it can start out quite rough and ready. For example, when you're using prototyping as we are in the what if phase now to develop and explore ideas. Feedback can be feedback from your colleague or casual feedback from a participant. But as you move on to use prototyping in the latter stages of the what if phase and in the what works phase, it becomes more rigorous and you're clearer about the measures of success that you're looking for and your tests are more rigorous and your learning processes are more rigorous. But right now, it's about using prototyping to develop ideas. And there's lots of different ways you can do it. paper and screen-based prototyping, for example, sketches or visualizations or storyboards or simulated forms of flyers or brochures or clickable prototypes. While they're often really useful at the early stages of a process like this, and we use them in Family by Family to develop those ideas with families, we used a lot of kind of brochure-based prototyping of this potential new service that we were developing. Tabletop prototyping is a way of modeling a system or a service on the table using three-dimensional objects like Lego or children's toys, and using those to act out interactions over time. And it sounds quite childlike, but it's really good for building an understanding of how systems work. And it's really good because you quite literally can get a lot of people around the table, lots of different stakeholders, and use that to act out different scenarios quite quickly and cheaply. Scenario prototyping can be a drawn comic strip or a storyboard or a video or a written scenario even. And it's good for efficiently testing solutions that operate across time or geography or demographics. And it's also really good when a team is more comfortable with writing than creating visual outputs. Enacted prototyping can be simulated role plays or improvisation or theatre-based methods. Role-playing can be a particularly efficient way to develop more detailed concepts within the design team. Or you can do it featuring actors and use it with an audience. Enacted prototyping like role-play can really help you refine the nuances of a particular interaction between people. So this method is really important when that interaction between people is a critical part of your solution. Framework prototyping is about modeling intangible aspects of a service or system using a framework such as a theory of change or a business model canvas or a user journey or a service blueprint. And this stuff is so useful in the what if stage for developing up an idea into a well-rounded scenario that's got lots of different perspectives to it. So the change perspective and the business perspective, the user experience perspective, etc. You can use them to get feedback from people with lived experience, people who might be the intended beneficiaries of a service, but you can also use all of those things to get feedback from experts, so somebody knows about how change happens in this particular area, or somebody who is good at creating business models. In the What If Diamond, prototyping is a tool for exploring ideas and giving them more depth and detail. You can use prototyping to move ideas from something that is a sentence or a sketch into something that's got many, many dimensions. Typically, in social innovation, you're interested in how something will create change, what the experience of it would be like for a member of the public, how it would be delivered, what all that would cost. And you may also be interested in how something would work politically or publicly. Using different tools, prototyping can help you flesh out all of those dimensions. For example, prototyping a theory of change could help you work out how actions lead to outcomes, with feedback from participants, but also experts in what creates the kinds of changes that you're focusing on. Prototyping the user experience through role play or scenarios or storyboards, or even by building a space or a fake website, can help you determine what kinds of experiences are seen as desirable and give you insight into what it would take to make them happen. Prototyping a business model canvas or a back-of-the-envelope costing can help you flesh out the ballpark costs and revenues associated with a particular model or policy. And prototyping the promotional material or a communications pack could help you refine the public messaging related to a particular policy or service. Back in 2018, in the earlier days of the National Disability Insurance Service, we worked with the innovation team of a major disability provider to help them develop what we'd come to call breakthrough NDIS services. In the What is Diamond, we conducted peer research with the diversity of people living with disability and identified a number of opportunities for new services. Then, in the What If phase, we started to give shape to those services, developing a business model, back-of-the-envelope costing, a theory of change, and a service blueprint for each of the 7 new concepts. We planned a most-of-day session for people from across the business to come together in one place and jointly make a decision about which concepts had the most potential to advance to the next stage of prototyping and then potentially implementation. In advance of the session, we'd given each of the decision makers a pack of materials that introduced the 7 concepts. Each concept had a name and brand, illustrations which showed what the concept would look like in practice, findings from the research that gave the rationale for the ideas, as well as feedback on the ideas from people living with disability who might use them. Back-of-the-envelope financial calculations illustrated how this would work within the strict NDIS pricing structure. Broadly, we were asking the panel to judge what was good for people with disability and good for their organisation. This included thinking about the increasing quality of life that each of these service concepts could generate for people living with disabilities, the number of people for which a particular concept would be relevant, the feasibility of the organisation itself delivering the services based on its current capabilities, how concepts aligned with the organisational strategy, and the strength of the financial model. During the day, and in small groups, the decision makers discussed the relative merits of each idea, placing coloured cards, each representing a concept, on large 2x2 matrices of the criteria. The idea was to provide an informed discussion on the relative merits of one concept over another. Many of the panel shifted their thinking in that process about what solutions had the most potential, and 2 were chosen to progress to live prototypes. This was a way to make well-informed choices, but also to gain buy-in across the organisation. Just like the end of the what is stage, considerable effort needs to be put into communicating concepts, often to a number of stakeholders that will see things from different perspectives. And also, just like the end of the what if stage, this needs to be done in a way that excites people and helps them to imagine and feel the potential of a concept from a number of different perspectives. At this stage, visuals of what things look like, storyboards, or even films and animations can be useful tools to bring things alive. The choosing process I've just described around disability services is for a service concept where desirability, potential impact, feasibility of delivery, strategic alignment, and financial viability were all in consideration. For policy, all of those things I think are still relevant. And there'll no doubt be an additional layer to explore political and public or media concerns with any particular idea. So what's bad and what's good when it comes to what if? Well, bad is squeezing creative work into an incredibly tight and stressful time frame. Good is dedicating time and headspace for the team so ideas can come to the fore. Bad is idea creation by the same people that created the current solution. Good is creating a space for a diversity of people to come together and suggest new directions. Bad is a lack of inspirational reference points. Good is setting out to find those reference points, often as part of the what is stage of research. Bad is using a singular approach to idea generation that might only suit some people. Good is using a diversity of approaches that may include different people, different contexts, and different kinds of prompting. Bad is idea generation that doesn't include some kind of making and feedback to learn, for example, role play or paper-based prototyping. Good is several loops of learning with feedback from participants and different stakeholders, for example, the finance people. Bad is an unevenly realized set of concepts presented for decision making, with some concepts better presented than others. Good is a set of concepts presented for decision making that are evenly well presented and can be easily compared like for like. Bad is an overly complicated set of selection criteria. Good is selection criteria that encourage looking to the potential of the idea in the future, because you don't know if it will work yet. Bad is a transactional approach to choice making. Good is an approach to choice making that encourages deliberation, hearing others' views, and allows people to shift their perspective. Bad is a set of concepts that pretend they've everything worked out. Good is a set of concepts that identify the greatest remaining uncertainties and propose a way to test them in the what works stage of work.